This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Most people recognize the importance of sleep, and most will say they rarely get enough. Surveys bear that out. 31% of Americans sleep less than 6 hours a night, and almost 70% of us report insufficient sleep. There are many reasons why so many struggle to find enough pillow time, but one thing is clear: the negative effects of too little slumber, not just on mood or productivity, but increasingly, research shows severe impacts of sleep deprivation on our health. Today in The Exchange, the science of sleep, why those hours in dreamland are so important, why so many of us get so little sleep, and how to get more. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Joining us from Hanover, Dr. Brooke Judd, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. And Dr. Judd, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Dr. Elizabeth Klerman. She is an associate physician within the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Klerman, a good morning to you, too. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, and Dr. Klerman, to you first. So we're going to talk a lot this hour about so-called adequate sleep and enough sleep. So let's just start right there, Dr. Klerman. What's enough?
It's probably different for every individual, but I usually answer when somebody asks me that by asking something back to the person. I say, how much do you sleep on weekends and vacations? Do you need an alarm clock to wake up? Do you need coffee to get up and going in the morning? If you can sleep as much as you want, how much is that? And that's a good start. There's probably a slight variation in how much sleep people actually need, but it's not as great as that of most people think. Most people probably need between 7 and 9 hours. Most healthy adults need between 7 and 9 hours, and younger children need more than that.
And teenagers, and we'll talk about them a little bit later, right, Dr. Klerman? They need a lot of sleep and are not getting it. It's kind of scary. But what about those people then, Dr. Klerman, who say, yeah, I know the recommendation is, 8 hours, but I'm fine on 5 or 6?
So there probably are a few people who only need 5 or 6 hours of sleep, but multiple studies have shown that people actually don't realize how much sleep that they need. And in some ways, they don't even realize they're tired anymore. So if I asked you how alert you felt, and I also asked you to set up performance tasks, then when you start, if after a few days of getting insufficient sleep, your performance would start to degrade, but you would probably report that you only felt slightly less tired than you did in the beginning, even though your performance is significantly longer than that.
So you can
significantly worse.
You can give people tests and say, look, you're not doing as well as you could.
Right. So I say you wouldn't need rumble strips on the highways if people were accurate judges of whether or not they were alert and responding appropriately.
What do you see, Dr. Judd, among people who say they come to you and they say, I'm fine with 5, 6 hours? Are they kidding themselves or are they truly set up to get less sleep than most people need?
Well, I would agree with Dr. Klerman. There are likely a relatively small number of people. They're called short sleepers who don't need as much as most people, but no, most people really do need more. They get used to functioning and feeling a certain way on the amount of sleep that they're getting, whether that be intentionally not getting enough sleep or sometimes, and my line of work. We see people with sleep disorders where they may feel like they're sleeping, but they're not actually getting good quality sleep. But they get used to feeling a certain way and don't really recognize it as abnormal. And often when they indeed do get more sleep or do have their sleep disorder treated, they say, oh, I really was tired.
people really
do feel that it's, well, most people would fall asleep at a traffic light. they begin to think that certain things that they're doing are just the norm and that most people would feel the same way. And once it's treated, they realize that it really was a problem.
Dr. Judd, do you ever get people who are hesitant to commit to, 9 hours of sleeping? I mean, that seems like so much time and everybody feels so busy.
Absolutely. It's very difficult to get 9 hours of sleep. And again, most people would, it's the range of 7 to 9. So most people need about 8. It's possible, but people do lead very busy lives and can often have a very difficult time figuring out where they need to make some lifestyle changes.
All right. The alternative
becomes feeling poorly, having it impact your quality of life. Sometimes people alternatively use medication or substances to make themselves feel more alert, which may also not be a good way to handle the problem.
But there
can be difficulty arranging your life to accommodate your sleep needs.
Well, and there's so much to talk about, including some of the substances that you mentioned, Dr. Judd. Dr. Klerman, I just want to ask you real quickly, too. Didn't you do a study of bringing sleep-deprived people in and just let them sleep as much as they wanted? And what happened?
So thank you for asking about that. We did a study in which we took healthy older and younger people, and we told them that they could sleep as much as they usually did before they came into the laboratory. So we got their sleep-wake patterns for 3 weeks before they came into the laboratory. The first night when they came in, we let them sleep their average time, so when they would go to sleep and how long they would sleep. The next morning, we started what are called the multiple sleep latency tests. So multiple, because there are 5 of them. Sleep latency, because we looked to see how long it would take them to fall asleep. And for some of the people, they fell asleep within a minute. In other words, before the technician had left the room. And the speed at which they fell asleep depended on how little or much sleep they got before they came into the lab. So the people who were sleeping 6 to 6.5 hours were falling asleep much more quickly than the people who were sleeping 9 to 10 hours. And actually for the first few subjects, I think for the first 17 subjects, everybody fell asleep on all 5 nap opportunities, which was really surprising. And then we put people on a schedule in which they got 12 hours of sleep at night, opportunity at night, and 4 hours during the day. So they had a nighttime sleep opportunity and a daytime sleep opportunity. And during these sleep opportunities, they had to stay in bed and they had to, and it was dark. So they couldn't get out of bed early. They couldn't get out of bed until we told them to. And on the first 24-hour day in which they had 16 hours in bed, the average amount of sleep was 12 and a half hours.
Wow.
Which is more than anybody was sleeping at home. It was slightly higher in younger subjects than in older subjects. And remember, nobody had sleep disorders, so that isn't why they were sleeping more. After around 5 days on this, the younger subjects' level was still over 8 hours, and the older subjects' level was a little under 8 hours. And then we did another one of these sleep latency tests, and almost nobody fell asleep. So if you wanted to argue that the reason people were sleeping so much is that they were bored, they would have fallen asleep on the multiple sleep latency tests at the end. But instead, we think that what was happening is that they weren't getting enough sleep at home, and that what happened when we gave them time to sleep and didn't let them out of bed so they couldn't curtail their sleep opportunity, they slept closer to what they needed, in which for younger subjects would be a little over 8 hours, which means you have to be in bed for that more than that. And for older subjects, it was slightly under 8 hours. Whether or not this means there's a difference in older and younger subjects is a little complicated, but certainly it suggests that people need, as we said, between 7 and 9 hours. The other point about sleepiness is that frequently on these multiple sleep latency tests, people didn't realize they'd fallen asleep. We asked them, how long do you think you were asleep? And the technicians were waking them up within a minute. And frequently they'd say, oh, I didn't fall asleep at all.
Because they were so tired.
Because they're so tired, and also in the introductory early stages of sleep, you don't realize you're asleep, stage one sleep around half the time people don't realize they're asleep. If you asked somebody, if you gave somebody a button to push and you said every time you hear a tone or you see something on the screen, push a button, in stage one sleep, they only respond around 50% of the time. And if you wake them up, they say, oh, I wasn't asleep.
Sounds like someone I know. Let me invite our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the science of sleep and all that we know these days about how important it is for our mental and physical health. 1-800-892-6477. We're also finding out why most Americans don't get enough sleep. And a little bit later, we'll talk about how people might be able to improve their sleep. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. So, Dr. Judd, everybody knows that they feel better, they perform better when they've gotten a good night's sleep. But beyond that, what would you say to a patient who says, why is sleep so important?
Well, you know, interestingly, we don't know why sleep is important. Nobody really knows the function of sleep. You know you need it. You know, you feel pretty poorly if you don't have it. It's not clear what's happening during the process of sleep. There are theories about it, about memory consolidation and learning, but it's unclear what's happening during sleep. You know, clinically speaking, people feel poorly. There's a difference probably between health effects of people who voluntarily or knowingly don't get enough sleep versus insomnia, which is trying to sleep but feeling like you can't, versus not getting enough sleep because you have a sleep disorder because there's something interrupting your sleep, such as something like sleep apnea. So those all may have a variety of different physical manifestations. Certainly the sleep disorders such as sleep apnea have significant clear associations with increased cardiovascular risk. There's evidence out there that insomnia without sleep apnea or without another underlying sleep disorder may also increase cardiovascular risk. Clearly impacts, all three of these can impact quality of life from mild to severely, which can also impact work performance. So there's multiple effects of clinically what one can feel when not getting enough sleep, although what's happening during sleep is still unclear.
All right. We will definitely dive into that with you too, Dr. Clerman, after a short break. And some of those health impacts that you mentioned, you know, heart health, mental health issues, lack of sleep linked to depression, and other health issues. We'll also talk about the cultural values that we have towards sleep in this sort of go-go American culture. All that coming up, and we'll take your questions and comments, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what you need to know about the science of sleep and why so many Americans don't get enough. Our guests are Dr. Brooke Judd, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. Also with us, Dr. Elizabeth Clerman. She's an associate physician within the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. The number for you to join us with your questions, comments, frustrations with sleep, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Clerman, before we go to our listeners, I want to hear from you too on that question I asked Dr. Judd just before the break. You know, everyone knows they feel better, they perform better, they're more cheerful when they get a good night's sleep. But beyond that, what are some of the health effects that we know about that sleep gives us?
That's an excellent question. I'd like to start with a quote by Alan Rechtschaffen, who was one of the founders of the field about sleep, a study of sleep. And he said, if sleep doesn't serve an absolutely vital function, it's the biggest mistake evolution ever made. If you think about it, sleep is a time in which we're not moving around, we're not aware of our surroundings, and therefore we're vulnerable. We're not eating, we're not procreating, and so why is sleep so heavily defended by the organism? Sleep is more than just making you feel better. I agree with Dr. Judd that We don't know all the functions of sleep. However, we do know that insufficient sleep is associated with many of the things both you and she mentioned. It's with cardiovascular disease, with learning disorders or problems, with mood dysregulation. It's also been shown it's important for immune function. If people get insufficient sleep, they don't respond as strongly to a vaccine. So just about every physiologic function we know is affected by insufficient sleep, even if we don't know the mechanisms yet.
And I can understand, Dr. Clerman, you know, the association between sleep and depression and other mental health issues. But how is lack of sleep related to, you know, heart disease or diabetes? It doesn't seem as close a link.
I don't know the mechanism. Many great investigators are working on that question right now. We don't know the mechanisms. We just know from a variety of studies, from epidemiologic studies in which you look at large group of people and there's associations between amount of sleep they get, whether or not they're overweight, whether or not they develop diabetes, whether or not they develop heart disease, to inpatient studies in which you look at a small group of people very intensively and you give them less sleep and see what happens to physiologic markers such as whether or not they're having a normal response to a meal or something that looks more like they're having diabetes. So there's a variety of studies involved, but we don't know the mechanisms yet.
Yeah, and I have seen those studies linking lack of sleep to weight gain and all the impacts there on out. One more question, I think, for you, Dr. Judd, and then we'll go to our listeners, lots of folks who want to jump in our conversation. One of you mentioned earlier, you know, substances that people use to help them get that coveted sleep. Boy, you go into the drugstore, Dr. Judd, and, you know, Tylenol PM, Motrin PM, Lunesta, Ambien, do those, they help you go to sleep, for sure, but do they result in just as good a quality of sleep as you would get sleeping naturally?
There are a lot of medications or substances that are used for sleep. Some of them are considered over-the-counter. You don't need a prescription. And all those PM preparations that you said, Advil PM, Tylenol PM, another over-the-counter preparation, in a sense, is alcohol, which people often use to help their sleep. And then there's a number of prescription medications of a variety of different classes that, through somewhat different mechanisms, make you sleepy, make you sleep more. Do they work? You know, much of the effect of sleep medications is actually very subjective. Objectively, many of them have surprisingly little objective improvements in sleep. So if you did a sleep study, so fully monitored sleep study where you're measuring brainwaves and sleep, and there's actually some video so you can see when people are sleeping, the difference between how much sleep people feel like they get with sleep medications versus how much they objectively get is actually pretty different. Usually these sleep medications, even the prescription ones, increase total sleep time by maybe anywhere in the range of 10 to 30 minutes.
Wow, not that much.
It's not that much. Much of it's subjective. The over-the-counter ones, those, the PM preparations,
sure,
those are the medication that's in that is an antihistamine, diphenhydramine, or Benadryl is the name that people commonly use or commonly know. It's a really good antihistamine, but it's hard to use as an antihistamine because it makes you really sleepy. So it's been used as a sleep medication a lot. And the research on it is that it is sedating, but people lose that sleep medication effect after a few days, although subjectively people often feel like it works. So there's actually not a lot of evidence that particularly the over-the-counter medications and some of the herbal preparations that people use.
Like valerian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is there a placebo effect? Is that what you're saying, Dr. Judd? We say, hey,
yes,
I took a Tylenol PM, so here
mm-hmm.
I go.
Yes, there probably is. And that's not necessarily a bad thing because it does help people feel that they're sleeping better. The part that becomes dangerous is that the medications can have side effects, which is, you know, potentially a bad thing. So Tylenol PM or that medication that's making them sleepy has a lot of potential side effects.
Well, let's go to Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, because people feel like it's over the counter. They feel like they can take more of it that's recommended and can develop some significant side effects.
Let's go to our listeners. Lots of people who want to jump in our conversation. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Whether you're feeling alert or kind of sleepy, join us with your questions, comments, thoughts on the latest research on sleep, how much we need, what it does for our brains and our bodies. 1-800-892-6477. And Barbara is up first. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi.
Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Barbara Jago. Hi. I didn't realize I was going to be put on. My name is Barbara Jago. I'm a professor of communication arts at UNH, and I wanted to offer a comment related to the cultural context in which sleep occurs. I teach a course on images of class in the media, so this is related to class. I think that we've really pathologized the need for sleep to the point where people say, oh, I'm not sleeping, or don't sleep as long as they need to. For the working poor, I think that that's especially problematic. They're already economically disadvantaged. And now with the election going on and even beyond that, we're hearing comments about how lazy they are and they just need to work harder. And that certainly, you know, causes all kinds of problems, especially in relationship to their health.
Well,
so I'll go off the air.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in, Barbara. And what do you think? Both of you can probably answer this. I'll turn to you, Dr. Klerman. You know, this sort of cultural disdain for sleep and that we should be up and running around and productive and doing things.
I agree that when you're awake, you should be up and moving. But I also think that when your body needs sleep, it needs sleep. It's not lazy to need sleep. Sometimes you're more productive if you sleep rather than trying to do something when you're tired. I remember once I was visiting my daughter at college, and she was literally falling asleep trying to do her homework. And
wow.
I said, why don't you take a nap? And she said, because I have to finish this. It's due tomorrow. And I said, but if you take a nap, you might actually finish it faster. I agree that there are real problems with some people who have commitments that mean they do not get enough sleep. But it's not I would never say that somebody is lazy because they have the need for sleep. Sleep is important for their ability to function when they're awake, and also there's increased risks of errors and accidents when people are sleepy, especially when driving. There's increased risk of therefore hurting themselves and others, especially in a motor vehicle. As Dr. Judd said, somebody thought it was normal to fall asleep at a red light.
Wow. That's a little
really
scary. Right.
But I have had people say the same thing to me. Is it normal that I fall asleep at red lights? And there's increased risk of accidents for people driving home after long periods of time. And so it is a difficult world for many people who cannot get enough sleep for what they need. But I don't think it's a class issue. I think sleep is important for people's health and for that of others.
And do you think, I'll throw this to Dr. Judd, do you think that overall, you know, regardless of class, we're all sort of told that we're better people if we are up and being productive and not lying in bed, so to speak?
Absolutely. This is not a new phenomenon, actually. And I have on one of my presentations, which I don't have immediately in front of me, but there's a slide with a quote from Thomas Edison, who says basically a quote to the effect that if you get less than 4 hours of sleep, you're wasting your life.
Wow.
So this
easy
is
for
not
him to say.
New, sure. So this is not a new phenomenon. I would definitely agree that it's very problematic. I also agree that it's not really class-based. I think that the working class and the poor working class is feeling a very definite pressure to have to work multiple jobs, and I see that day in and day out. I see people all the time who are very sleepy, and they don't have a choice. They have to work multiple jobs. The other side of that is I see students, because I have children, and I work in a college town, and I see students who are very sleep-deprived, because they feel so much intense pressure to complete all the work that needs to be done and to achieve. And so I think it goes both ways. But I don't think it's new.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara, for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Mike is in Bedford. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious. I had was very busy with one job and started taking Advil PM. It lasted for a lot longer than I wanted, but was just taking about two pills a night, and I was just wondering about side effects, and then also what does the doctor recommend to prepare yourself for sleep, especially for people that are light sleepers?
Yeah, good sleep hygiene, so to speak, Mike. So you're not taking this this Tylenol PM or Motrin PM or whatever anymore?
I just got off it, but it had been probably a two-year period.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, that's a long time. Thank you very much for calling in, Mike. Do you want to take that, Dr. Judd, good sleep hygiene and finding a way to get good, healthy sleep without the Tylenol PM?
Sure, yeah. So one of the side effects that you sounds like you had with the Tylenol PM is that it's actually really long-acting, and it makes people feel groggy in the morning. So another reason why it's not a great medication. It can have some other side effects along with that. So sleep hygiene, the idea of sleep hygiene is to make your sleeping environment and your sleep schedule conducive to good sleep. So part of that is some physical things. So having your room be quiet and dark and cool. A cool room is better to sleep in than a warmer room, which is a little challenging right now in the summer. But for most of the year here in New Hampshire, it shouldn't be a problem. One of the important things is with the schedule to not so much maintain a rigid sleep schedule, because really you can't fall asleep until you're ready to fall asleep. But more importantly, wake up at a fairly consistent time. So sometimes people sleep in to make up for not getting enough sleep. So they sleep later, and then it makes it more difficult to fall asleep the next night, and that becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. So, you know, go to sleep when you're tired. Wake up at a reasonably consistent time, even on weekends. Sometimes people, especially if they might work until later in the evening, they really do need some wind down time to just shut down a little bit, do something relaxing. Another thing that comes up is watching TV. Should people watch TV? Should they do computers?
Right. Don't relax with your Facebook page, right? Because those blue lights will keep you up.
Right. So there has been a lot of recent information about it's the wavelength of light that comes off of LED screens. So it's any, you know, computers, televisions, most of the e-readers that are lit. So the original ones that don't have their own lighting aren't as bad. But anything with a lit screen emits a wavelength of light that is activating to your brain and tells your brain to be awake. So trying to keep it lower light, not having those types of screens in front of your eyes in the time before you go to bed. We had talked about alcohol somewhat, but alcohol is not good to have before bed. It can make people feel more tired, but it actually gives you worse quality sleep. So that's part of sleep hygiene, is avoiding alcohol before bed. Caffeine. Caffeine is actually pretty long acting. It lasts about 8 hours. So avoiding caffeine, you know, after lunch usually.
And there's so many caffeinated drinks available, Jolt mm-hmm. and Monster and Red Bull and everything else. Thank you for that call. Let's take another one. This is Vicky in Keene. Hi, Vicky. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting. And I guess Vicky couldn't wait any longer. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Matt's in Conway. Hi, Matt. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Yeah, I'd like the panel to speak on the changes of sleep patterns for teens and how they may be negatively affected by the early start time in high school. I know up here our high school starts at 7:30, kids are getting on buses at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Oh, I just read something this morning, Matt, about teens and sleep. And boy, Dr. Klerman, we can talk and talk about the importance of sleep for everybody. But from what I've read, for teens, it's especially important because those brains and bodies are just growing like crazy.
So I absolutely agree. Sleep is very important for teens. They are growing like crazy, and they're expected to get up very early in the morning to go to school. In addition to most teens probably not getting enough sleep, there's very good evidence out of the research by Dr. Mary Kerskaden at Brown University, which suggests that teens are actually shifted later in their body clocks, their internal timing, than both younger and older individuals. So it's actually very difficult for them to go to sleep earlier because their body clock is later. It's as if you're living in New Hampshire, their body clock is somewhere on Colorado or California time. And now you're asking them to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, which is hard enough even for older people. So there's also studies across many individuals which show that the choice of timing gets older across adolescence. So later and later and later. It's slightly later until they're around 22 or 21 or 22, and then it starts drifting earlier, the times of preferred sleeping or waking. So one person, Dr. Till Ronenberg, suggested that this is a marker of the end of adolescence when this starts tracking earlier rather than later. We think it's biological because it starts trending later earlier in women versus men, and girls tend to have puberty earlier than boys. And so the trend, the whole curve is shifted a little earlier. So to an earlier age of a later time. So I totally agree. When my children were in high school, I tried advocating for a later start time. And the school said, but what about all those after-school activities? And my response was, I thought school was more important than after-school activities, and did not get a response. So it is a very difficult problem. The school systems sometimes only have one set of buses, and you don't want kindergartners outside at 6 o'clock in the morning if you try and shift the high schoolers to a later point in time. There have been some studies in boarding schools and other places where shifting school... I'll finish it after the break.
Sure, where you're not quite as tied to this whole district. So definitely finish that up after a break, and we'll take a lot more of your calls, too. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what you need to know about the science of sleep. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Two sleep experts join us for the hour, Dr. Brooke Judd. She's with the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, and Dr. Elizabeth Klerman. She's with the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And both of you, before we go back to the break, I did want to let you finish up, Dr. Klerman. We had a caller who asked about teens. A lot of research shows that most American teens don't get enough sleep and that it's especially harmful for their developing brains and bodies. You were starting to give us an example of a private school that was able to start everything later and the impacts that they saw.
Thank you. So the impact that they saw was that students did better in classes, there were fewer mood problems, and it was considered beneficial. Unfortunately or fortunately, there's politics, not just science, involved, and I'm happy to work with others to try to provide the science needed for people to make these decisions.
Well, if you of all people couldn't get your district to change, right? I mean, there you are at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's, and you still weren't able to do it. What were some of the factors sort of pushing back against this?
Well, I'm not a politician. As I said, the answer was kids have after-school activities, and if we started later, it would interfere with jobs or sports, and as the issue with busing. I don't many decisions are made on not just science but on other considerations, and I don't know everything that the school committee used to make their decision.
All right. Well, I'm sure a lot of parents can relate to your frustration. Let's go next to Berlin, and Vetti is on the air. Go ahead, Vetti. No, I think we're going to go to Peterborough, actually, where Kathleen is with us. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I have a question. I was in, had my physical in the spring, and everything was fine, they said. But I have gone in the last recent months from being happy on seven and a half hours a night sleep to wanting 9 hours. So I have a question for your experts there. Stress a major factor? Like, I came home yesterday and my neighbor had her music just blasting away and just not quiet and peaceful.
So you're wondering, Kathleen, as we go through life, do we need more or less amounts of sleep? Is that
right.
your question?
And also, does stress influence that much as well?
Oh, sure. All right. Well, go ahead. I think I'll turn to you first, Dr. Judd, on that.
Sure. Stress does play a role in how you feel. It is fatiguing. So as sleep medicine doctors, we try to separate out sleepiness from fatigue, which can often feel the same to people, but are different in terms of sleepiness is not able to stay awake, as opposed to fatigue, which is, you know, wanting to rest, wanting to sleep. And that multiple sleep latency test that Dr. Clareman spoke about earlier was one of the ways that we try and differentiate those. But we do know for sure that stress, multiple other mental health issues, depression, anxiety, all of those things can make people very fatigued, can make them feel more tired during the day, and can play a role.
And yet if you're stressed, it's hard to fall asleep, Dr. Judd. You're kind of worried about whatever's
exactly.
stressing you.
No, you're right. They're very intimately connected. We also know that the anxiety, depression, and stress can contribute to insomnia. There are some ways to manage that. So sometimes that's meeting with somebody to help work on your stress and anxiety. But there are also some self-help types of ways of going about it. And
some of the good sleep hygiene that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, that and it can go a little past that. But some behavioral interventions to help decrease stress and anxiety about sleep.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Emily. 2 points. Emily says she keeps talking about the side effects of taking Benadryl for sleep. What are they? And Emily also says, have they talked about people who can fall asleep easily each night but cannot sleep through the night? Let's see. Dr. Judd, I'm going to turn to you first about the side effects real quickly of some of these medications, and then maybe Dr. Clareman on the people who fall asleep easily each night but can't sleep through the night. Thanks, Emily, for the Facebook comment. What are some of the side effects of these medications, Dr. Judd, that we've talked about?
So in particular, that the diphenhydramine or the antihistamines that are in the over-the-counter medications can have side effects that can be vary according to person, although it tends to be more problematic as people get older, particularly in the elderly. But you can have things like blurred vision, dry mouth, constipation, urinary retention. So those types of side effects. And the medication is probably a little longer acting than people realize, so there can be a hangover effect in the morning.
And to you, I think, Dr. Clareman, what about the second part? People who fall asleep easily each night, but then they're up.
That issue is actually fairly common among middle-aged and older individuals. I get lots of complaints from friends about that, being of that age range myself. We're not exactly sure why that happens. There's some people who believe that older people, quote unquote, need less sleep, and therefore when they go to sleep, they can fall asleep easily, but then they cannot remain asleep, especially since the body clock will start trying to wake you up early in the morning. And if you're younger, you have a larger drive for sleep, and you can therefore sleep past a little through the beginning of this wake-up signal from the body. But if you're older and you haven't built up as much of a drive for sleep for whatever particular reason, then you might be awake and lie awake for a while. But the other more interesting response to this is actually some evidence that human beings actually had two sleeps. If you, I'm blanking on the author's name right now, but he published a book in which he reviewed books and literature and historical accounts of people's societies before the advent of electronic lighting. And people used to have what's called a first sleep and a second sleep.
I have heard about that, yeah, from talking to historians. Go ahead.
That's right. And so people used to fall asleep and then be awake for several hours in the middle of the night and then go back to sleep again. And so I usually tell people that if they don't worry about it, they'll probably fall back asleep again. Don't read something that's blue light emitting in the middle of the night. But it may indeed be what we are biologically destined to do. And if, on the other hand, you still wake up tired, as the previous caller said, then you may have to make some other adjustments. And I just want to add one thing to what Dr. Judd said, which is that you might be getting 8 hours of sleep, but if the sleep is disturbed from a sleep disorder, in which you may not be cognizant of, something like sleep apnea or leg movements, then you might be in bed for 8 hours, but you are not really sleeping for those 8 hours. And so the person might want to consider seeing a sleep physician to find out if something has changed in their sleep.
Well, Emily, thank you for the Facebook comment. And here's an email from Kate who says, can your guests address napping for adults? If we need 8 to 10 hours, what does having 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon make the shorter nighttime sleep better or more difficult? We've got a couple emails actually here about napping. Anybody want to address that, Dr. Judd? You know, good, bad, indifferent, hurt the nighttime sleep or not?
Well, you know, as Dr. Clairman just said, there is, on the one hand, a potential history of a natural cycle of having two sleeps, and that second sleep is in the afternoon, what we would consider a nap or what people call siesta or something like that, which actually correlates with a what's called a circadian dip, so that you have a body clock, your circadian rhythm that guides, helps you determine when to be awake and when to be asleep. And it does have this dip in the afternoon, which makes people more sleepy. So there is a natural inclination to want to sleep in the afternoon. Although that being said, if you get what we consider adequate sleep at night, so in the 7 to 9 hour range, people don't feel the need for that nap. And in fact, that nap study test that Dr. Clairman spoke about earlier proved that they weren't sleepy during that time. So some people can take a short nap in the afternoon. They enjoy it. They're able to sleep at night. It's not problematic. It may mean that maybe they're not getting enough sleep at night, although clearly there are people who will have more trouble sleeping at night. Your body only does need a certain amount of sleep, so if you get part of it during the day, you won't get it at night. Which, if you had altered your schedule, if you say, well, I need 8 hours of sleep, so I'm going to get 2 of those hours in the afternoon and 6 of those hours at night, it's different than if you still try to get those 8 hours at night. It tends to not be a good quality sleep. That sleep would be more fragmented because you've already gotten some of it, makes sense.
It does. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for the email, and Kate. And let's go to Marcia in Bradford. Hi, Marcia. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think I got a part of the answer before, because the question is about not staying asleep, either taking a long time going to sleep, sleeping for a couple of hours, waking up, perhaps staying awake for another hour, half an hour, and then going back to sleep. Maybe in bed for 8 or 9 hours, but what kind of sleep do you really need?
Right. Very frustrating, too, isn't it, Marcia, to sort of be in and out and up and down. Thank you for the question. You know, we haven't dug into so much about quality of sleep. And, you know, Dr. Judd, we can say, good quality of sleep, but if you're up and down and not really in that deep dream state, do you feel better when you wake up?
No. You don't. So frequently what happens with sleep or with having difficulty sleeping is it's actually not abnormal to wake up multiple times a night. What becomes abnormal is if you wake up and then feel like you can't get back to sleep, and then it becomes its own problem. People get focused on being awake and then try to make themselves want to sleep, and they get frustrated about being awake, which makes them more awake. So this is part of when we try to address this, we would work with behavioral therapy. So medications are one way to help people sleep, but another way to help people sleep is actually behavioral intervention. So you start to unconsciously develop a set of behaviors and thoughts about sleep, and then begin doing activities that you think are helping your sleep but make it worse. So
such
very
as?
Commonly, people, what your caller has said is a common scenario. They fall asleep but then wake up after a couple hours, which in and of itself may not be abnormal, but they can get themselves, again, unconsciously, but learn this pattern of behavior. They wake up and then are frustrated and then stay in bed because you think, well, maybe if I rest, it'll be better than being up, or maybe I'll fall back asleep. Often people look at a clock. They keep checking a clock, which always makes the problem worse. It just gets them more.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, and it never helps you get back to sleep sooner. So people develop a maladaptive set of behaviors to try and make themselves sleep more by staying in bed more. Often part of it is staying in bed more. It's a behavior that's learned. It's not learned on purpose, but it's something that can be unlearned. And we are fortunate enough to have cognitive behavioral therapists who specialize in insomnia at our institution, and we have people work with them at times. There are also some books that people can read that talk about this problem and what this problem is and how you can help break that cycle. But you're, you know, at 2 a.m, when I tell you to get out of bed because you're not sleeping, it's hard to do, and I understand that. But it makes the problem worse when people stay in bed.
Yeah, you just get frustrated. Well, mm-hmm. And to close out with both of you, and I'll turn to you, I think, first, Dr. Clerman, you know, we've talked about how important sleep is for the body, you know, anything from heart disease to diabetes to obesity, the brain, you know, depression and productivity and so forth. So everybody agrees we all could be better sleepers. What changes would you make, Dr. Clerman, you know, if you could rule the world for a day, what changes would you make in the way that our businesses are set up, our workplaces, retailers, schools, I mean, anything to make us better sleepers? Like, would you close down those 24-hour, you know, grocery stores, for example? Would you make every high school start at 9 o'clock? Would you put nap places in every workplace? What would you do?
That's an excellent question, and I've never really considered it. I'd be too worried about making one change that would affect so many others, as our first caller said. I would just like people to know the importance of sleep, so both the employers and the employees, so that if possible, changes be made for people's health and safety, so that they're not considered lazy if they say they need to sleep, and they understand the health implications and benefits if they do get enough sleep for themselves and their employers and the rest of the world and their family.
So a cultural shift is what you'd like to see, an attitude shift, that we're not sort of lie-abouts, so to speak.
Right, that sleeping is beneficial, it's not lazy, and it will help all of us.
How much do you see that attitude changing, Dr. Clerman, as all this, you know, amazing science comes out about what happens when we sleep and how important it is?
Well, the fact that you and other people have heard some of what we've been saying about the importance of sleep and its effects on multiple physiologic and health parameters, and even that light at night affects your ability to fall asleep, means that we are starting to help people understand the importance of sleep. So it feels like we're helping and we're starting to get the message out.
Dr. Jeb, real quickly, because we're closing out, one change you would make, just one, to help everybody sleep better.
No screens after 9 p.m.
All right. So if your screen mysteriously shuts off after 9 p.m. tonight, somehow Dr. Judd has found a way to make that happen. How hopeful are you that that will happen, Dr. Judd? Do you think people are getting a clue or not?
I think globally it won't happen, but I do think more on the more individuals and families, I think people do understand that or are starting to understand that. And understand the impact it may have. So I do think that can happen. Probably okay. Not everybody shutting their screens off at 9, but
well, thank
but they're
you.
Getting there.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Judd, thank you. It's been good to talk to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Brooke Judd, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. Dr. Clerman, it was great to have you, too. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much to everybody.
That's Dr. Beth Clerman, again, associate physician within the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Noah Bunnell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.